Blog Talk Radio.
I am Mother Nature. I am the universe. I can make a miracle from a twisted curse. But my soul is getting weaker as.
Ooh, okay. Not sure what happened there. Hello, everybody. Judy, are you on?
Hello.
I'm not sure what happened to the music. It just suddenly cut off. But go ahead and introduce the show.
Hello, everyone. This is my very first Blog Talk Radio show, and I'm very, very pleased to introduce Dr. Harmon. Dr. Harmon is a parent alienation. I guess I would call her a specialist. She received her doctorate from social psychology from the University of Connecticut in 2005. She specializes in the study of intimate relationships. She also has two master's degrees from Teachers College, Columbia University in psychology counseling, and served as a family and substance abuse counselor for several years prior to her entry into academia. She is currently an associate professor of psychology at Colorado State University. She's also done several TED Talks on parent alienation, and I'd like to introduce her this evening. And Dr. Harmon, are you on?
Hold on. I'm going to bring her on in a second. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Hello,
yeah,
Dr. Harmon. Are you on? Go ahead.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. I'm hearing a little bit of static on the line, but I'm hoping that maybe
yeah.
It's not coming through on your side.
Yeah, I'm trying to clear that up. Go ahead. Okay, go ahead, Judy. Take it away.
Okay. Dr. Harmon, thank you very much for coming on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Lulu, I'm hearing too.
Yeah.
Are you hearing
it? Yeah.
Hold on a second. Let me see if I can clear that up. Better?
Much better.
So. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There we go. That was still a little bit, but better. Yes.
Okay. I'll keep trying to clear it up.
Yeah. It's still there, Lulu.
Okay, I'm trying to get it up there. Okay, I'm not sure where it's coming from.
What are you getting, static or echo or what?
It sounds
like
total static, Robin.
Yeah,
do what now?
Like a static or like...
Okay.
A little... It's coming back here and there, whatever we talk.
Yeah. Maybe that was... That might be from... Dr. Karen's phone.
Dr. Harmon's phone.
Yes, and Dr. Wrong voice. And you might want to hang up and try to get a call back in, and we'll talk in between that and maybe see if that will clear the line, okay?
Okay, you want me to try to call back in?
Yeah, let's see if that's not the
okay.
issue, okay?
Yeah. Okay, all righty. Okay, bye.
Okay.
You know, it's funny. Just before we went live, we talked about the fact that sometimes there are difficulties that happen with these shows that are unforeseen.
Yeah, I know. Judy, you for this?
I can still hear the static.
How's that better?
Still there.
Yeah. I'm not sure where it's coming from. This might be a bad connection.
Maybe we should have.
No, that wasn't good to do. Is that any better?
Nope.
Wow, that's so strange. Anything I can.
Well, now.
Okay.
Okay. Is that any better?
I think so. A little, yeah. I think it's a little bit better.
Wow.
Well, we're hearing you clear. So perhaps your audience is too. If you can go on, just proceed.
Yes, please do.
Okay.
So, Dr. Harmon, I contacted you a few weeks ago, and you told me that you're working on a new paper regarding parent alienation. Can you tell us a little bit about the research that went into that paper, and what is the paper all about?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember. I'm working on several papers at the moment, so I'm trying to remember which one I shared with you. I think probably the most recent one I'm about to submit for publication, we're looking at the kinds of behaviors that parents use to alienate their children and trying to understand or characterize best what specific patterns or preferences parents have for the kinds of behaviors that they're using. And so in other words, like looking at, for example, are they using more direct strategies, which would be things like, you know, yelling at the other parent at parenting time exchanges or blocking communication and access to the child, or are they using more indirect strategies, such as bad-mouthing the parent to other people, filing false allegations of abuse, increasing loyalty of the children to them. And so in that study, we had two different samples. We had samples of parents who we interviewed who were alienated from their children, and then we also had appellate court cases where alienation was found and across the United States. And what was interesting is we found that moms and dads both tend to prefer using indirect strategies overall. So these are, which makes sense. They're not in a relationship anymore, and they don't see each other as often to have a lot of direct contact. And direct strategies are much more easily identifiable, right? And you could get in trouble for them more easily because people can recognize them and, you know, do something about them. But actually, they tend to prefer using more indirect strategies, which are harder to find. They're more circuitous and kind of insidious kinds of approaches to alienate children. And what we find also is that mothers tend to use twice as many or so indirect strategies over direct strategies. And so what this tells us is that when people like custody evaluators and other people are looking at these families and trying to assess if alienation is occurring, that it's going to be harder to find it. You know, interviewing parents and observing kids isn't enough. You really need to look at long-term behaviors over time and looking at patterns of behaviors over time because those indirect behaviors aren't going to be really readily available when you just interview a family, right? You find them in emails, you're going to find them in voicemails and, you know, police reports and all these other sources of information. And that because we find that there's some gender differences and preferences for use too, it could mean also that it's going to be harder sometimes for custody evaluators to always see what mothers do. It's going to be a little bit easier probably to see what fathers are doing because they're using about equal numbers of each of those kinds of behaviors. But that's one paper we're working on, and we're about to submit it for publication in another week or so. So those results are pretty interesting, I think.
Dr. Harmon, would you categorize the indirect characteristics as covert? Because I hear that a lot with people like Dr. Childress, where he kind of refers to that type of behavior as covert behavior. Is that what you're referring to as indirect behavior?
Yeah, the term indirect aggression is used more by researchers to characterize those covert behaviors. So indirect aggression is a term that's used like for behaviors such as gossiping and backstabbing people, trying to tear down their reputation. And so that would be kind of those types of behaviors. So,
you know, given the amount of cases and dockets that a family court judge handles in the run of a day, I once went to the court, the Boulder County Court, and I noticed that there is, for the most part, on a Thursday afternoon, most judges handle between 4 to 8 dockets in the run of a day. this type of behavior, I mean, it must be known amongst the judges that parents are doing whatever they can to harm the other parent. Why do you think it's so why do you think judges really don't come forward and, like, recognize what's going on in these cases?
Well, I think, you know, like you said, they're seeing so many cases in a day, and only so much evidence could be presented, right? And so oftentimes, I think there is a function of some judges haven't been educated to understand what alienation is and how it's different than other kinds of child distancing or rejection of a parent, such as with estrangement. And a lot of people, even mental health providers, haven't been provided that training. So in a short period of time in front of a court or in front of a judge, when both sides are presenting evidence, the amount of time it's going to take to go through the evidence to show that to a magistrate or a judge, you need a lot more than what they're usually allocated, right? And so I think there's a combination of both education and not even having enough time, even if somebody did have all the education, to go through the case and figure out what's going on. In fact, I've talked to a few judges actually down in New Mexico, and this was a concern of theirs because a lot of parents don't have money for an attorney. They don't have money for a custody evaluation. And the judges who had attended a training that I had conducted down there voiced a desire to kind of learn more about how much time do I actually need to help figure out what's going on in this case, because it seems like the normal time that they normally spend with these families is never enough. And I think they're right, you know, and I think a lot of judges do recognize that, that have some training and understand what alienation is or have learned about it. I think sometimes their hands are tied in terms of, you know, amount of, you know, time they have to help these families, and the parents oftentimes don't know how to really prepare their case in order to make the best case possible.
So what advice would you give to attorneys that are running into these cases? I mean, it's very interesting to me. I have a lot of admiration for attorneys. I think they have a terrible job when it comes to family court. I couldn't imagine having to listen to, like, all the conflict every day of my life. And I'm just wondering why so many are so uneducated in this area. And it seems like they really don't understand what's going on.
Right. I think it starts with maybe the courses taught in law school. I mean, I don't know of any course that or law school that actually has courses on this kind of problem. I think, you know, they have courses on high conflict or, you know, what they call high conflict divorce. And, you know, and I always have a problem with that terminology because I think from the on the surface it looks like high conflict. But this kind of violence is what is actually quite similar to intimate partner terrorism, because in this kind of violence, this family violence, there's a lot of power inequality that's happening in these families. And it's different than like the run-of-the-mill family where they're going through a divorce and there's conflict, they don't like each other, and they're both kind of behaving badly. And when that happens, that's when you see kids in a loyalty conflict. You see kids who are kind of stuck in the middle, and it's not good for them. But the parents generally are trying to do well by their children, right? But with parental alienation, it's different. You have a parent who's very abusive, and they were probably abusive before the relationship ended. And that abuse is carrying on after the relationship ends. And it's a very asymmetrical power situation where the alienating parent has a lot of power. They have the loyalty of the children. They often are controlling visitation, controlling access to the children, or gatekeeping. And so when they go to court, you know, they're, you know, on the surface it looks like, oh, my gosh, this is a high-conflict family. But that would assume that both people are doing it. You know, whenever we often hear conflict, we assume that both people are, perpetrating this conflict. When that's not really what happens in these families. For the most part, it's one person perpetrating it, and it's creating a lot of conflict. But it's not inherently a problem with both people. And so So I think, you know, when lawyers are in school, they're learning about these high conflict cases, and there's sort of this assumption that both parents are contributing and, you know, trying to mediate this relationship and solve the, you know, resolve it peacefully. And I think maybe that can happen in maybe more mild cases of parental alienation, but not in the kinds of cases that tend to have to go to court. So the much more moderate and severe cases, you know, we wouldn't call an intimate partner violence relationship where you have like a batterer and a victim, you wouldn't call that a high conflict relationship, right? You would call that an abusive relationship. And that's really what these relationships are like. So I really wish that hopefully maybe law schools will start to teach this as part of a class on domestic violence, because that's what alienation is. It's child abuse and domestic violence. And then we can start, I think, treating this better. But you know, I think it's going to take a little while for that to happen. But it is happening. It's slowly happening. I mean, there's appellate cases. There was just one that passed in Nebraska today. An appellate ruling just went in where they found alienation at the lower court, and it was upheld at the higher court, saying that they won't tolerate that kind of abuse of the child. And so I think it's there's slowly changes that are happening, I think, in the judiciary, and that's thanks to the lawyers also that are representing these families.
Dr. Harmon, one of the things that really concerns me in the Boulder County Courts, where I've been since 2013, is when a child reports sexual abuse to a parent, it's almost like they flip that and they make it sound like every parent that's reporting sexual abuse of a child is making it up to harm the other parent. What percentage of the cases do you think that are put forward in the courts, in the family court system, that are actually true?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer for that. part of it is getting access to lower court rulings. You know, it's I don't work at a law school, and I have to work with lawyers who have access to legal cases. And in the United States, really, you can only get rulings on appellate cases. So it's hard to know that. So a lot of the questions, and I've had similar questions, because there's always questions about how many of them are false accusations, how many of them are have legitimate basis to the claim. There was one study I saw actually that was published. It was a review of cases in California that someone was able to look at within one courthouse. They found that, and I don't remember the exact percentages, but I mean, they pulled a large sample of cases where they, I think there were, I mean, there were a lot of false, or there were a lot of allegations of abuse, and a significant portion of them were not substantiated, meaning, I mean, there were no police reports, there were no hospital records, there were, you know, nothing to back them up, right? And then of those, there were a lot that were found to be actually false, like where they actually determined that later the child said that they were being manipulated or something like that. But that doesn't mean that that happens all the time. There's still a large portion of cases where that is happening, right? But there's a lot of times no way to know that. And but it, unfortunately, a lot of the cases and claims of them, unless they're substantiated, they won't go anywhere, you know? And so to the degree that a parent can have proof of that, that's a research question that I don't know how to get the data to answer that. So, but that is a real problem that I think even custody valuers are always having to grapple with, because you're having to kind of sort through what is actually happening. And that's why I think anybody who's trying to look at alienation and domestic violence cases and child abuse cases, they have to be forensic interviewers. You really have to try to get to the bottom of that, because you're dealing with the child's, you know, best, you know, their health and their well-being. So.
One of the things, and I feel like I'm a professional PRE recipient, because I went through parental evaluations, and not one of my evaluators, you know, mentioned trauma. They didn't mention our children's trauma. They never even talked about how separating children from the majority parent when it comes to custody will affect them. And our children went through having being with their mom 78% of the time to no time. So why do you think the psychologists are not, like, putting this in front of the court?
Yeah, this is something I actually talk about a lot, especially, and it's kind of, I try to use the analogy, or not the analogy, but the example about all the children that are separated from their parents who've come here illegally, right? And, our government's lost 1,400 of them, and we don't know where they are, and they've been separated from their families. And what's interesting is now the argument is that it would be too traumatizing to reunite them with their family, which is hauntingly familiar to what we're hearing judges say and opposing counsel for the alienating parent, that it'd be too traumatizing to reunite the child with a parent that they were attached to. And it's fascinating to me that we see this even on the national level and how we're treating immigrant children. And we do this in our own courts too, right? That there's this assumption that taking a child away and one child is good or one parent is good enough for a child, and it doesn't acknowledge the grief and the loss that the child is feeling. And I think in the case of alienation, it's compounded by the fact that the child is not even allowed to grieve with the alienating parent. And so you have a child that's grieving the loss of someone, and then they're in a situation where they can't even acknowledge that they miss them and love them. And that is, I think, almost it compounds the trauma for that child because they're not allowed to work through their grief and loss, and they're being forced to deny feelings that they have. And, it's really unfortunate. I think that a lot of mental health providers don't see that. And I try to do my best. I was even on a master's committee thesis for a student once at Colorado State University, and she had expressed this opinion that, well, children only just need one parent. And, and I was like, what do you mean? if they're bonded to two people or more, like, let's say it would be just as traumatic if you had a grandparent living in the home with them, and then the grandparent moves out and they never see them again. The child's bonded. It's an attachment bond that the child has. Too often we don't recognize the importance of that for the child's sense of self and their identity and their development. And I think it does a real disservice to our kids.
So one of the things I experienced in my 7 years career with Boulder County Courts is the inability of our policemen to understand how covert our abusers act. And I have been in situations where my only contact with my own children was by phone. And during that conversation, there was a lot of interruptions. There was a lot of noise. Why do you think our police force are not taking action and considering this some form of harassment?
Right. And I think there's sort of a – I think it really depends on the behavior that you're talking about, right? Because I think the covert behaviors, it's harder for them to really recognize the easier ones for them to see are kind of deliberate blocking of contact when there's a court order and that kind of thing. And I think there's a lot of variability in how police handle that. I've heard some great stories about police stepping in and saying, look, you can't be, stepping in on behalf of the targeted parent and really trying to assist them. But I've heard other cases where, I've heard other cases where the police don't get it, or even they're in collusion with the alienating parent. I think it comes down the same thing with kind of the legal system. There has to be some education, and I know I see time and again, there's so much push for legal reform, and I think that's absolutely necessary. But I think to make this a real change, to address parental alienation, you cannot just target one system, right? We need to target police. We need to target schools, because oftentimes schools are very kind of involved in the alienation unwittingly. They get roped in and they believe the tales of the alienator, and they, you know, take the other parent who has a legal right to be on or their school records and other things, oftentimes take them off, or they will interfere with parenting time or the rights of the parent to see their child at school when they don't. That's not their right to do that. And so there's so many things that have to happen across all these systems to address parental alienation that it's a bit overwhelming for me as somebody who's an interventionist, and I'm sure it's even more overwhelming for a parent who's going through this to deal with this. And, I mean, I say that also as a targeted step-parent. I know exactly kind of that feeling of just, like, where do you even begin to address this problem? But as a social psychologist, I see everything in systems. You know, I see how kind of we address change in one system and then how that has to then be adjusted in other systems in order to accommodate that change. And we have a lot of work to do in that regard.
Dr. Harmon, I read your story, 1, 2, and 3. Would you like to speak a little bit about that? Because it brought me to tears. So maybe you could kind of talk about your experience. What I find very interesting is that, you know, I've been through so many psychologists who really don't understand how alienators target their prey. And what I found so just incredible, interesting about you is that you live through what most of us experience, and you've used that to help others. So could you talk about your own story a little bit?
Yeah, I'll tell a little bit. I try to kind of keep some details out because we still have the minor children with us. And as you know, the alienating never stops. It never ends. And so, yeah, I mean, it really began. I mean, my current husband, my husband, and he and I met, and the alienation for him had already begun well before the marriage ended. He was slowly being pushed out of his relationship with his kids. His ex was, you know, really monopolizing the time, really starting to kind of try to erase him out of the picture, but not quite erase him because she was so kind of wound up in hatred and anger towards him. And there's always revenge and manipulation and everything that's involved. And it just got worse when we started dating. And yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to sit. I don't even know. Anytime I hear what other people have been through, I'm like, okay, yeah, check. I've been through that. I've been through false allegations, been through attacks on social media about me and ridiculous claims about me. And had to have the police kind of finally step in and try to stop the behavior towards me. Yeah, I mean, it's been anything you can imagine, you know, like poaching a nanny that we had and trying to get her to spy on us for a while, and it's just, you name it, they try to do everything insidious to get at you. And I mean thank God, you know, my husband and I have a fantastic relationship, but I know so many parents who, you know, when they're involved in the situation, it really puts such a toll on the relationship that they just end the relationship because it's too painful to live through. And I even have a good friend who cuts herself she's a healthy parent and very successful, but now she's gotten to the point where she's cutting herself because she can't release as an adult. That's something you hear that teenagers do, but it's so painful for her, and she can't express her fear, her anger and frustration at being attacked by the kids all the time. Being told her food tastes like dog food and, you know, all this stuff, and that's happened to me as well. I don't express it through cutting, but I express it obviously through trying to understand the problem better. Like when it started happening to me, I finally was like, I just need to figure this out. And why is it, as a psychologist and somebody who studies relationships, I've never heard of this term, you know, this alienation word? Why is it that I was never taught this? Or even know what it is? And so I got really frustrated with that, and I started trying to read more and more, and I saw that most of the work that had been done so far, and this has been from a clinical perspective and from a legal perspective, and that makes sense because clinicians and lawyers are in the front lines of this, and they're seeing it in their practices, but it hasn't quite reached the level of, the scientific inquiry that would make it something that I would have learned about in graduate school. or even in my own readings. And so that's kind of when I decided, you know what, the only way I'm going to really, I think, cope with this and how it was work, you know, to make sense of what was happening in our family is really to try to understand it better. And so, of course, I read everything I could on it, as I think probably a lot of your listeners have done as well as yourself, read everything I could get my hands on. And I guess I'm in a fortunate position at the university where I'm able to access all the articles that have been published in journals. And so I devoted, you know, kind of a year to about 2 years reading everything I could, and then just started doing research on it. And part of it, when I started first doing interviews with parents, was maybe kind of feel like, okay, I'm not alone in this, right? I felt like, okay, every story I hear, there's pieces of it that are happening in our own life. And there's sort of it's a sadness to it, but there's also a comfort to it that, okay, I'm not going crazy, you know, or, you know, I'm not doing anything to deserve this. And okay, it's validating in a way. But of course, then that makes me more angry as the more it happens to hear that this is happening to people all over the world that I've interviewed. And it's the same story over and over and over. And it's such a predictable violence, and the outcomes on kids are just, it's horrendous, you know, the stories that you hear, but they're all so similar because they have the same elements to them. And so that's really what got me into it. I mean, the alienation, it never ends. It's always evolving. I think fortunately in our case, the kids are starting to get older, and we've been able to manage maintaining 50-50 custody, which has been a struggle, but we've been able to do that. And I think if we hadn't gotten that, and we haven't fought for it tooth and nail, and I mean, there were many attempts to try to get that away, but it hasn't been easy, because even though we've had 50-50 custody, the alienation, it never ends. And so it's sometimes been a real living hell with the kids, but other times it's been okay. I'd say probably 85-90% of the time it's okay, but every now and then it's really bad. But I think it's getting better because they're finally getting older and going off to college, and we've been able to maintain it with the custody that we've been able to hold on to. So, but I know a lot of people, even if they get 50-50, they're unable to kind of hold on to it. So I guess we've been fortunate in that sense, but it's not easy. And I completely get the struggles of, you know, having to get through the day and, you know, function through the day when you're dealing with this. So
I love Dr. Childress. I mean, his work is amazing. But one of the things that kind of throws me off, and one of my concerns about his research is how he identifies the pathogen. And I grew up in a very kind, loving home. I think my parents fought once in front of me. My abuser had the opposite experience. He had a very violent childhood. What I'm wondering is, do you believe the cycle of abuse is what's contributing to parent alienation?
I think it is for a lot of people. I don't think everybody. I think just like any other kind of abuse, if you've seen it modeled for you, then that's what you're used to, right? Just like physical violence and sexual abuse. I mean, not everybody who's been sexually abused grows up to be a sexual abuser themselves. So I don't think always having alienation modeled for you will make you be that way. So I think there are a lot of limits to that. The issue is, though, you know, like when relationships fall apart and that's all that person has seen modeled for them, then that's what they're going to do, because they're going to believe it's okay. They're going to believe it's all right. But there are also a lot of people, I think, that, you know, have serious personality disorders, and they don't necessarily have to have lived through that in order to alienate. I know in the case of our alienator, that wasn't the case at all. The family wasn't abusive. There wasn't any of that going on, but there's some major personality disorder things going on. So I think there's a lot of potential causes for why people do this.
Your family of origin is definitely one of them, and intergenerational transmission, which is where it's transmitted from one to the next, has definitely been found, but I don't think it's the case for everybody.
One of the things that I experience is not only being alienated from my children, but I was alienated from the school. I was alienated from doctors. I was alienated from therapists. I've read reports where I was referred to as severely mentally ill. And I think that's a common factor in these cases. And could you kind of comment on that?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, you know, my work is really showing that this type of violence is like intimate partner terrorism or intimate partner violence. And if you think about the models that we have or the frameworks we have for understanding that kind of violence, a lot of it's based off the Duluth model. And the Duluth model is based on kind of feminist theory from, you know, advocates working in domestic violence shelters with women. And it was originally written primarily, obviously, that men are the perpetrators, right? In fact, even all their wheels of violence are written from the male perpetrator perspective. I'm actually writing a book chapter for a book being published by Demosthenes Lorandos and Bill Burnett, where I'm writing the chapter with Mandy Mathewson, and we're kind of outlining all the behaviors that these parents do, and we're using that framework. We're using that Duluth model framework and adapting it to this problem, because when you look at the behaviors that alienating parents use, they fit into those categories. And so the wheel has categories such as using threats and intimidation, economic abuse, which alienating parents use a lot of, psychological abuse or emotional abuse, and one of them is using isolation. And so that gets right at what you were just explaining, is that alienating parents will isolate not only the child, but they'll try to do everything they can to isolate the targeted parent. So they will turn everyone against them. Right, they will, you know, turn family, friends, neighbors, extended family, schools, you know, teachers, mental health providers, anything they can to shut that the alienate or the targeted parent out. And so it's a very common strategy, just like it is with other abusers.
So, Dr. Harmon, I'd like to open this time up to questions for other listeners. Are you comfortable with that?
Sure. Yep. Okay.
Lulu, are you here?
We're here. Wow. We've been listening, and
this is an excellent interview, Dr. Harmon. You really have shared some amazing information and are kind of opening the doors on something that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. And I think that they need to be, because this is our courts don't seem to recognize oftentimes the dynamics of these relationships, and our even in families, it's sometimes there can be covert kinds of undermining and alienation going on for years, and it's sometimes difficult to spot. I know,
right.
in my own background, I have experienced some degree of these kinds of behaviors, and it was, I remember that the day it dawned on me that I needed to change my relationship was a day when I realized that it was, that my children were being taught, don't respect your father, don't listen to your father, he's not important, doesn't matter what he says. And when I realized that was going on, I hadn't even realized, maybe, and I don't know, you know, maybe it was going on for years, I don't know. But I had not realized. I knew that I was in a relationship where I was having a hard time finding myself respected at all, and that I was having a hard time, you know, maintaining any kind of relationship that was meaningful or positive, but I didn't realize that my children were being taught not to respect and love me. And when I realized that I had to reapproach my whole relationship, and it became a point in our marriage when it became very tough for a while because my whole relationship to my spouse changed.
Yep. Exactly. In fact, even if we go back to that Duluth model that I was describing, undermining the parental authority of the other parent is one of the tools that they describe. Obviously, it's often described for female victims of battery, but we see that also for fathers and mothers who are dealing with alienation. It's not gender specific in this case at all, but it's the same strategies are used like that. And so, you know, trying to turn that child against, and obviously using the child as a weapon, is one of the many strategies that these parents use to hurt the targeted parent. Yeah, so.
And the covert nature, the fact that it can be hidden, you know, for quite some time, it's, you know, I've recently, in recent years, I've read about gaslighting, and that is to, you know, tell someone what your perception of reality is wrong, and there's no one doing anything to you. It's just that you are the problem, and when in fact, you know, you're being victimized by someone and don't realize it because they're manipulating your perception. Can you address that a little bit?
Yeah. In fact, the paper that I just published in Psych Bulletin in December, paper where we talk about parental alienation as family violence, and we outline all the ways that they do it. And we mapped on all the behaviors, not using the Duluth model, but we used instead just common definitions that are listed by, you know, National Institute of Health and NIMH, or National Institute of Mental Health, that we have identified for domestic violence and child abuse. And one of them, so psychological abuse, obviously, there's many ways people do it. They use coercive control. They use their privilege against the other person, and gaslighting, right? And so in that paper, we talk about some of the ways that these parents gaslight. And they'll gaslight not just the parents, but the children, right? They'll get the children to think that things happened that never really did and make them question the reality. And, you know, and as a targeted parent, oftentimes people feel like they're just going crazy because they're being told things or getting emails from the parent where they're rewriting things that have happened in the past to kind of create a new history or a new story that they can then refer back to, even though it never happened. But they oftentimes will kind of, they'll twist things around and make the targeted parent feel like they're losing their mind because they just, it doesn't make any sense, right? And that's really common. I mean, you see this a lot. And that is a very covert thing, especially when they're doing it to the children, because you're not there to witness it off, you know, usually, and you're not there to hear how they're doing it. And it's very, very manipulative and very insidious. You know, it's, you know, and some of it can be, you know, I've seen parents who, there's been some cases I've actually seen where the parents really don't do a lot of bad mouthing and they don't do a lot of that stuff, but there's so much loyalty inducing behaviors and guilt that they put on these children, that the children essentially are then kind of, it makes it appear that they've done this on their own, like that they've agreed to be manipulated in that way. But there's not a recognition about all the gaslighting and other things that are going on behind the scenes that have made that child so loyal to that parent as a way to kind of, you know, avoid rejection from them. So that's really what these parents are doing. They're creating this dynamic where the child is completely dependent on them, and they have no choice but to believe the reality that they're spinning, you know, even though it's not reality, but their reality that they're trying to have the child believe.
Yeah, I remember one incident in particular that was when I had realized that this was a relationship that needed changing, and I started to stand up to my wife and say, look, and I do want to say that eventually what happened was I stood up to my wife and and was able over a course of about two and a half years to basically persuade her that it just wasn't worth it to keep attacking me. Her behavior changed, and we actually had a really lovely relationship for just a few years before she died. So it was something that turned around. But before that happened, I remember one incident when she said, when she was very angry with me and she got up and jumped up and started trying to hit me, and I grabbed her hands and blocked her legs as she was trying to kick me and hit me, and she said, "Kids, look, your father's attacking me. Your father's attacking me." And I said, "Now, kids, I want you to look very carefully, because you see that all I'm doing is restraining her from attacking me. I am not hurting your mother. I'm not doing anything to hurt her, and I don't want to hurt her. She's trying to attack me, and I'm just preventing that." And they could see that was going on. But, you know, these are all sort of the symptoms that I found that I was dealing with when I started to deal with the kind of the disorder in our marriage that had developed in this way, where, you know, all of these things were coming out that I didn't know were going on, and as they began to dawn on me, and my behavior changed. I started to stand up to her, and when she would scream at me, I've got a great big voice, and I would scream louder, and then I'd stop and say, "Okay, if you like that behavior, then you continue doing it, and I'll continue doing it, and we'll see who can yell louder, because I know I can. So if you don't like that behavior, let's both stop, and we'll talk about things calmly and rationally and work things out in a way that everyone has respect for each other." And that was the treatment that I'm not recommending for anybody, but that is what happened with me, and how over a course of about 2.5 years, she just realized it was futile to try to constantly be attacking me, because not only am I physically stronger, but I could overpower her verbally as well. And she just realized that to constantly attack, it wasn't worth it anymore. And then once she stopped, then I was able to reason with her peacefully and calmly and help her to change her behavior. And when she did change her behavior, she realized how much she wanted to do that, and how she was really very grateful for the way that things developed, because we really did have a beautiful relationship for about 5 years before she died, after we went through this very rough period when I had to confront this abusive stuff that had come up. And when I look back on her background and history, I understand where a lot of it came from in her family. Her grandmother, she was raised by her grandmother, and her grandmother was one of the most verbally abusive people I ever saw in my life. And I think that, you know, growing up in that environment kind of did some things to her that made it hard for her to believe that she was loved and feel love. And so she was, I think, you know, ultimately with some kind of psychological testing that she felt she had to do. But it would have destroyed our marriage if I had been a little bit different kind of person and had just said, "Look, I can't take this," and run away, instead of saying, "I can take this, and I'm going to stand up to it, and I'm not going to let you destroy what we have, because we've got children here that are being affected, and because it's not the best thing for you or for me." And so that's my history. That's a little bit about me that people might not know.
Right. Yeah.
So, Robin, you bring up a very good point. And one of the things that I've read and reread is that alienators have a history of abandonment. Dr. Harmon, what do you think of that theory?
I think that that's true. I mean, I think that kind of ties to the other question that you had asked me earlier about this intergenerational kind of transmission. I think that's true for a lot of people. But I see this more as, you know, I look at this as, let's look at the kind of like the violence that this is. And I see this as somebody who, you know, people who are alienating their children They're striving to have sort of control and dominance is really what it is, because it's very similar to a batterer victim dynamic. And when we look at, in my research, we find that typically what's described by parents is just this constant need for control. And no control is ever enough. So even when a parent has all control of the child and the other parent has no access, they'll do everything they can to maintain this. And as the children get older, their control is continuously threatened, right? Because the child is trying to develop more independence and individuality. And so, and we see this kind of behaviors of trying to maintain control, especially when there's greater depression or anxiety in that parent. Now, I think it could be because of feelings of abandonment. It could also be some mental health issues, like with anxiety, depression, and other things, which may or may not be due to family of origin or genetics. We don't know. I think we can kind of always, it's always interesting to think backwards when we see a behavior and we try to think, well, what's causing this behavior and why is this person this way? And I think from a prevention standpoint, at some point that is important. As an interventionist, I'm less concerned about how it got this way. I'm more concerned with let's understand what this is and try to prevent it from this person from behaving this way anymore, right? And so I try to focus more on that personally, because we need to stop this behavior to protect our kids, and we need to find interventions that will stop it. Hopefully then we can deal then with prevention. I don't think we're quite at the point. I mean, I work with people who are doing some nice work with like mild and moderate cases of alienation, which we don't have a lot of good interventions yet. And there's some people who are starting to do some revolutionary work in that area. And we need a lot more people who can do that in a very empirically based way. But prevention, you know, we're not there yet, I don't think. You know, usually when the worst case, you know, we have to address the kids who are being affected the worst, or the people who have already started smoking, we need to get them to stop, right? Or whatever the health behavior is. And then we can start dealing with prevention, you know? So if we say, okay, well, what's getting people to start smoking in the first place? Then we can get at, okay, well, if this person has some trauma in their childhood, or if they've been abandoned, you know, then we can start dealing with family issues to prevent that from happening. Now, I think, you know, it's a real problem. I just lost my train of thought, but I was just thinking like about how, with the intervention work, we know with severe alienators, and I know from people who do work with family bridges and who do the aftercare with providers or with alienators, the success rate of them is very low. Therapy does often not work. And in fact, it often backfires because the parents, all of them, in one of the studies I'm working on right now, all of them have really severe personality disorders. Now, that could be from their feelings, you know, trauma and childhood from their from their family of origin. But there actually are some genetic links for some personality disorders. So there could be some of that, too. So could be abandonment, but there could be a lot of other things going on. So.
Wow. And I have a question. This is Lulu, and we do another radio show, you know, so I just want to ask you a question. Do you think the alienated children, are they more, like, susceptible to growing up and doing that to their own kids? I mean, I know that a lot of it's behavioral, but isn't there, sometimes you can say, okay, I had it when I was a child, maybe I can stop doing it, but is it a progressive thing that can happen to be carried on to their children, or?
Or they become victims of, you know, an alienation themselves. So, or as an alienated, you know, parent. So I've seen it go both ways. I think sometimes if they've been alienated as a child and they're with a parent who's extremely controlling, then when they get older, they're attracted to another spouse who's the same way, right? And then when that relationship ends, now they're the targeted parent. and so it could go both ways. I mean, not all of them are going to do that. Hopefully some of them will end up in relationships with a secure person who is not somebody who's likely to alienate if the relationship ends. But I mean, obviously people tend to get drawn, they're drawn to relationships that feel comfortable to them and feel like that makes sense to them. And if all they had in their family of origin was alienation than being with a parent, another person that you're dating who has the propensity to do that will feel comfortable, right? It'll feel like, oh, they have a lot of the same personality traits and things as my parents, and that will feel easy, and then they'll end up in a relationship like that. And it kind of explains sometimes why you see this intergenerational, not just transmission, but mate selection. You know, people are choosing mates that fit what's comfortable. I mean, take a look at, you know, I think what was it with the Brad Pitt example, how after he divorced, or he's obviously still doing custody battles with Angelina Jolie, but he started dating, Goldie Hawn's daughter. Goldie Hawn's daughter. So now Goldie Hawn allegedly alienated her kids from her ex-husband. And so it's interesting then that Brad Pitt that is now dating or was dating her, right? So, you know, it's like, okay, you went from an alienating mother to a daughter who was alienated. And yeah, it's an interesting kind of dynamic that is kind of this repetition.
Kate Hudson.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I was always wondering about that myself.
Yeah, Kate Hudson.
I always say a lot of children will grow up and they will date somebody that's like their mom or their dad. Mm-hmm. I was always wondering that, if, you know,
So I was like, oh, no. I wish I could send him a message. Don't do it, Brad. Don't do it. Don't do it again. You already made that mistake.
Can I ask another question? The other night, we were Lulu has been doing aromatherapy. She's been studying aromatherapy, and she said she was starting on anatomy classes, and I went on Netflix and looked under anatomy and found something about the brain and how it forms memories, and we watched the show about this doctor who was addressing the phobias of people, and they showed how they apparently did this experiment with frogs, I think, where they introduced a gene that would make cells that were developed under certain circumstances light sensitive. And I guess they did in mice, maybe it was.
Yeah.
But in any case, they discovered that the way that memories are formed is when you recall something, your brain builds new neurons in the process of recalling, in the process of remembering
mm-hmm.
something. You're recreating and rebuilding it. And what this doctor did then was to take people into a room who were dreadfully afraid of spiders, where there was a tarantula, and she would activate that fear, and then she would give them propranolol, which is a blood pressure medicine that also blocks, apparently, some chemical that's involved in the process of creating memories that have fear in them. It blocks the fear part of the memory somehow. And
mm-hmm.
chemically.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would take these people back into this room with this spider. And, I mean, in just one or two treatments like that, and these people would be petting this spider. And, you know, they would really overcome this fear to a tremendous degree. And I realized that, that the way this applies, if we can activate a situation that has been traumatic for us, and then experience a situation and neutralize that trauma part of the experience, then we can actually build memories that will help us to overcome the trauma of our past. And so I just thought I'd mention it because it seems like some kind of variation on that type of therapy might help people who are caught in these patterns that are causing these kind of very self-defeating and self-destructive behaviors.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting intervention work and clinical work being done to try to address, you know, especially like PTSD and other things. And PTSD is actually really common among alienated parents because they're often isolated. They've been in a very abusive relationship oftentimes with this person who's, alienating them for many years. Their children are now turned against them and hate them or whatever, and it's so traumatizing. And, you know, especially if there's court involvement and police, you know, I know parents, like, every time the phone rings, they panic. If it's like, especially if it's an unknown number, they panic because they don't know if it's the police or if it's Child Protective Services, and they just have, they freeze and they can't, you know, they have all the symptoms of PTSD. And yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunities for clinicians to work in this area and work with parents who are being traumatized. And in fact, I've heard we shouldn't call it PTSD for alienated parents, because it's not post, it's ongoing. It's ongoing trauma. Every day it's trauma, because there's no single event. So in a lot of ways, it's even worse, because it's not just a one-time thing that's happening. It's living through a nightmare for a long period of time. And so it's a very different kind of trauma that it's really hard to resolve it, because, you know, people having to grieve a child that's not dead, right, and who's alive and well and who refuses to see you. So there's sort of this loss of a relationship with a child, and the fear constantly of being attacked or thrown in jail or whatever it is that the alienating parent's trying to do to them. So it is a very, very stressful thing. Yeah.
You know, my issue is why they don't see these judges in these courtrooms, why they don't see how much stress it's given these children. It just mind boggles mm-hmm. me, because I hear these stories, thousands of these stories every day. And you wonder why is it that sometimes, I'm not sure if it's a judge or if they, like you say, they might be uneducated, but why they can sit there and listen to these children, you know, in these courtrooms, want to see their parents, want to do this, and why it costs so much money for the other parent to go and visit. You know, it costs $150, $200 to go and have a supervised visit. This is their own child. To me, that's soaking in the money.
What's really confusing for a lot of judges is, even though the child in this case, in alienation cases, says they never want to see that parent, even though, and so that's confusing to, I think, to them, because they're, in their mind, they're like, well, if this parent hasn't done anything wrong, the child would want to see them, right? And I think it's just a real misunderstanding about alienation, because children who are physically or sexually abused by a parent often don't reject the parent who's doing it to them. In fact, anybody who's worked in foster care knows this, right? You work, you know, you see children who've been abused and all this stuff, and they want to go back to their family of origin. They still love them. You know, people, you know, it's that Stockholm syndrome almost. You love the person who's abusing you, right? And you will defend them tooth and nail. And so when a child is rejecting another parent, it's confusing, I think, to people, because it's very counterintuitive. And I think that is really what throws you know, people's sensibilities around, because it just doesn't make sense that a child would reject a parent. They must have done something really bad in their mind, and they're not. But then when people actually understand what alienation is, and they understand the process, and they understand what happens to the child when they're being alienated, you know, the psychological kind of transformation that happens with them, then it makes sense. And only when we start to understand that do we say, we need to take action on this. But then a lot of courts are unwilling to do that. I mean, a lot of judges are elected, and they, you know, sadly, are often very sensitive to, you know, rulings that they might make, because it makes splashes if they throw a mom in jail or they throw a dad in jail for their, you know, their kids, you know, or they take their custody away. And then, you know, there's groups out there that will do everything they can to get that judge fired. And I've seen it. The Bar Association is trying to now establish protections for judges and lawyers who work in this area, because they are constantly under attack by special interest groups who don't want they don't want alienation to even be recognized. So there are a lot of pressures, I think, also for people who do work in this area who are trying to kind of stay in their jobs. Even clinicians that work in this area who do good work on alienation are constantly attacked. I get attacked, you know, I get attacked by people on social media, and, you know, people writing to the dean of my college to try to get me fired because I do this work, saying I'm just protecting abusers. And I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of attacks that people get who work in this area. And so I think there are a lot of good people who are doing work, but it's not easy work to do because there's a lot of people who don't want to see any progress made.
Wow.
You know, Dr. Harmon, it occurs to me, I just want to interject one more thing. That same show, I believe it was, talked about a researcher who took a bunch of college kids in and showed, demonstrated through this study that people could have false memories introduced to them and then be persuaded that those memories were real over a few interviews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would take a certain set of circumstances that were real, and then they would interject some absolute falsehoods, things that did not happen. Say, oh, yes, and then there was that time when you got in trouble with the police when they had to come and break up the fight that you were in. And this person,
mm-hmm.
the first time, no, what are you talking about? But the second,
yep.
third, fourth time, their resistance starts to break down because they've started to visualize it, you know, and they're taught,
mm-hmm.
they try to visualize what it was like if that had happened.
Right.
And after they've visualized
yeah.
it a few times, it's easier to start confusing reality with fiction. And you do that to children, you're going to be able to persuade them of all kinds of things that never really happened.
Easily.
And
they,
oh,
yeah.
Very real.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But
imagine a trusted parent is doing that, right? You know, so that's
right.
just like an experimenter, right? I mean, you have a trusted
right.
parent who's doing that. And there's decades of research. Elizabeth Loftus's work in particular has done a lot of that, where they interject false memories and crazy memories that no one would ever, you know, think to ever have a memory about. And people believe it. They firmly believe that it happened. And they will, even afterwards, even after they're told that they were manipulated, they still believe it. And those are just people that were in an experiment. You know, I imagine a child that where they're being manipulated with gaslighting and all that other stuff. Yeah, they'll hold on to memories that they'll fill in details. And we see that actually getting worse when kids are about 10, 11 and up. So younger children, usually what happens with memory like that is you'll have you'll introduce a memory, and young children are what we adults do. We fill in with details based on our past experiences, right? And young children don't do that as much because they don't have as much experience to interject. But as they reach at about 10, 11, now they start filling in. And so that's when we really see that kind of memory effect happening, where there's a lot more elaboration and changing of the memory over time. And memory, I mean, people think that their memory is like a tape recorder, and it's absolutely not. so pliable, and it's so fragile. It's really bad. And I've worked on a lot of cases, like criminal cases, where allegations of, you know, abuse come up, where, you know, one year a child's interviewed, and it's clear the child says nothing about abuse. They, you know, they're asked about it by police officers in a non-leading way. You know, they follow protocol, asking the right questions. They talk to doctors, and they ask them. And then, like, 2 years later, after going to a therapist, now all of a sudden there's these elaborate stories of abuse that are just really kind of far out there. And it's shocking, and Elizabeth Loftus's work too, is she's done that, where, you know, you can see how even beliefs about sexual abuse and things can often be planted in the therapeutic setting. And that's very scary if you're a targeted parent, because that's a very common strategy of alienators to do, is to try to take them to therapists who will kind of shop around until they can find one that can help, you know, kind of tell, create a story that something happened.
Wow. It's kind of
pretty horrifying.
Yeah,
those
are some of the really serious cases. Yeah, huh? What's that?
It's kind of like a form of brainwashing, though, isn't it? Sort of like, you're telling that child
absolutely.
Over and over again not to like, it's like telling that child
yeah.
over and over not to like your mother no more, or not to like your mother more. Before you know it, they're automatically brainwashed into not doing that.
I have a great example. There was a interview I had done with a father once, and his daughter was quite young still, so she wasn't quite manipulated yet, but it was actively happening. And they drove by a therapist's office once, and his daughter says, "Oh, that's Dr. So-and-so." He goes, "Oh, well, don't you like her?" No, because she keeps asking me questions that are wrong. He goes, well, what do you mean? Like, she keeps asking me, oh, when's the last time your dad touched your bottom? Or didn't you feel bad when your dad touched your bottom? And she's like, and I hate that because it's not true. Like, so she's even relaying to her father the leading questions that the therapist was asking because the mother had told the therapist about it. Right. So, you know, it's like that kind of thing. And then the daughter even said that, oh, I had to tell the police something. And mom told me she'd buy me a stuffed animal if I said it. Right. And she was still young enough that she can convey that and hadn't been manipulated quite yet. I mean, but sadly, it was clear that it was starting to happen. But so there is like an age in which you start to see alienation really taking root because the parent will have worked on that child for quite a while. And it's really sad to see, you know, that progression as a targeted parent when you see that child just slipping away like that, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Dr. Harmon?
Wow.
I have two daughters. One is very vulnerable because she has an intellectual disorder, and the other one does not. How often do you see the targeted child as being as child with the intellectual disability?
I've seen it. There's actually, interestingly, a few cases that I've working on where there's an intellectual disability, and it's very challenging for the parents because the child is kind of dependent for life, essentially. And so when there's alienation happening, you see it happening forever. I mean, you know, oftentimes it'll keep happening even with adult children, right? You know, we see it, you know, the child will still keep rejecting that targeted parent for many years, if they even, you know, kind of come to the realization at all. But with this kind of thing where you have a child who's a dependent, you know, and for many years, like if they're, you know, they have some mental disability, there's even more reason for that alienation to continue because one parent still continues to want all control, right? And you have a child who's constantly dependent on them. And so it's very difficult, you know. It's and the child was often very susceptible to the manipulations and things. And you know, I guess I haven't seen a lot of research on this because we don't have a lot of data on it. But I could just imagine that it could probably go both ways. Either the intellectual disability is so severe that the child might be kind of immune or not really understand what's happening. Or they could be easily manipulated. I think it probably just depends on the severity of that you're talking about.
Yeah. Wow.
So one of the things that just breaks my heart, when I recently took a cross-country tour, and I drove to Canada, and during my five-day travel, I stopped and I interviewed young people who were homeless, and I heard a pattern, a story that broke my heart. Most of the children that I interviewed that were homeless were abused, and they ran away to stop the abuse. What can we do to change the way that our judges are viewing trauma in our court system?
Oh, that's a good question. I try to, especially in alienation cases, I try to often write opinion letters to courts for parents to kind of say, here's why we need to take this seriously, because if we don't, here's what's going to happen. And sadly, I think, even though people think it's bad, I guess in general, there's just not a good way that people have thought of how to address psychological abuse. I mean, physical abuse, we don't do a great job of it either, but the physical abuse, we have child protective responses for it. I mean, we have a system that's not fantastic at all, but it's at least a system that's designed to deal with that. But the child protection services, it's mostly targeting physical abuse. And even then, you know, that system is so strained because you have a lot of people who are underpaid and undertrained and who don't understand, you know, kind of larger family dynamics and how to treat it, let alone alienation and psychological abuse. And, you know, even though research shows psychological abuse is worse than physical abuse in the long run in terms of the effects it has, there's not a lot of recognition because people kind of, they don't see it. You know, they don't see it. It's like it's something that happens over long periods of time. It's often hidden because you don't see physical bruises. People think that people are just fine underneath. And there's not a lot of recognition because a lot of the impact on the person will show later. You know, physical impact, you see it right away. You know, you see the damage. Psychological impact, it's much more, it's compounded over time. And unfortunately, then, by the time a child is suicidal or cutting themselves or using drugs, at that point, you're too late, right? Don't get me wrong. It's never too late to intervene. But at that point, it's so bad that the court finally takes action. When it shouldn't have to be when it's that bad that the court will finally do something, right? So I try to do as much as I can to tell the courts, look, if you don't do anything soon, this is what's going to happen. And sure enough, I've seen cases where I give them the warning, and then 2 years later, that kid's in the hospital because they committed suicide. I was like, I told you that this is going to happen because the alienation is so bad, it's inevitable that this is going to happen to this child, and sure enough, it did. And so, you know, I try to do as much up front when you see it early. Unfortunately, the courts don't want to take action because to take action means you have to do a hard thing. Right. If you have a child that's being abused, the hard thing is you have to take them away from their abuser. And with alienation, that's hard to do because on the surface, it looks like the child is very bonded to this person. Right. The child is really close to them. They're best friends. They're highly attached. They look like it's a perfect relationship and the other parent's awful. Why would you take them away from that? Like, that's how it looks on the surface to them. And I do my best to try to educate, saying it's not a healthy relationship. If you look closer, put a microscope up to this, it's a very unhealthy, abusive dynamic. The child is enmeshed. They have no identity of their own. They're completely at the mercy of this parent. And they're being brainwashed. They're being told things. And unless you actually take a close look at this, they're missing the abuse that's happening right in front of their eyes. Because on the surface, it looks fantastic, right? It looks like they're healthy and they're great, even though the child is suffering, and the child will never admit that they're suffering because they have bought into the whole, you know, alienation, and they've bought into the rejection of the other parent as the cause of why they're feeling the way that they're feeling. And so, I mean, until people understand the impact of psychological abuse and they understand how courts can start to until courts can actually start to say, we need to do the hard thing and take this child out of this abusive environment. My colleague, Edward Crook, he says, you know, we need to see this as a child protection issue. We need to take these children out of the environment, out of the hands of their abusers, and put them in the healthier parents' home or even healthier grandparents until the child can start to reconcile their feelings and reunite with the target. You know, somebody that the child can be with safely so that they're away from that abusive environment. But I don't know how that's going to happen. I don't know. Eventually, I mean, I keep trying to educate, but maybe when we see enough failures of the current approach, that there'll start to be a change in approaching this better.
Right. You know, that's what I was going to ask you is how is that going to ever be done? I mean, you know, we hear about all these really good parents out there that are not able to go in and be with their kids. And I know this one guy that spent over $1 million trying to get custody of his own kids back. And after a while, you know, mm-hmm. 2, 3, 4 years, he gets the custody back. I mean, how is this going to ever come? Do you ever see a resolution to any of it? I mean, it's hard,
well,
you know.
Yeah, it can happen, but I mean, it'll only happen if we recognize it for the kind of violence it is. If we see that if we treat it like it's like a intimate partner terrorism where you have a batterer and a victim, then that's how you have to approach this. Because that's the power dynamic here. Unfortunately, I think we tend to approach it like it's like the run of the mill kind of violence where you have both people just being mean to each other and nasty, and then And then they stop. And then, so what they'll do is they'll order these parents to go to mediation and try to fix it, or they'll try to do family counseling and therapy with the family. And that really only works with that kind of violence. It doesn't work with this kind. Time and again, those things fail. And the only interventions that really do work is when we treat it like child abuse. And you take that child away from the abusive parent, that abusive parent gets psychoeducation, just like you would with a batterer, right? A batterer who's abusing their child. You would have to do psychoeducation. You take the child, put them in foster care, you put them with a family member. You try to get treatment for the child then to help kind of learn boundaries and all that other stuff. And the parent has to get supportive services. And then they're only slowly reunited with their child when it's determined that they aren't going to keep abusing them. And I think that has to happen with alienation, because that's exactly that's what's happening in these families. But I think a lot of courts are just hesitant to do that. But when they do it, the results are amazing. Like a lot of the interventions, like Family Bridges, Turning Points for Families is Linda Gottlieb's program. Karen and Nick Woodall in the UK have a fantastic program. They're all modeled on the same kind of protocol, meaning that you have a 90-day no contact with the targeted or the alienating parent, at least until that parent has gotten into, some sort of therapy or education and aftercare. And then you have immediate reunification with the targeted parent, and it's done in a therapeutic way. And then it's followed up with aftercare. And within hours, the children, once they realize that they have no control over this anymore, that they have no say in the matter of whether they can see mom or dad, that it's out of their control and that the alienating parent is not going to interfere anymore, these children are able to reunite with that targeted parent very fast. And the success rate is amazing. I mean, I've seen this time and again with the people that I work closely with who do this work, and it's very powerful, and it's amazing when you see it happen. But the only way it happens is if you have court support for it and you have court orders to make that happen, and you treat it like child abuse, So, but that's really the, I think, yeah.
You have a book out,
sorry,
don't you? You have a book out, don't
yeah,
you?
I published a book about 2 years ago. Yeah, it's called Parents Acting Badly. That was sort of my first kind of setting the stage of my research right now, because I changed a lot of my research focus about 6 years ago, when it kind of coincided with my own experience with alienation. And so I first wrote a book that was sort of my way of getting myself familiar with the literature and understanding the research and kind of in my mind, reformulating what I think was happening. I was trying to discuss alienation from a social psychological perspective. Like, what is it? What are the bigger social forces that are operating that explain why alienation is happening and why there's so much resistance to understanding alienation, or so much resistance to even believing that it exists? And so, so my book kind of tackles some of those questions. And I co-authored that with a colleague of mine, Zeynep Berengin, who's also at Colorado State University.
So Colorado State University is, where's that at now exactly? I know there's universities, but where's that? Is that a...
We're up in Fort Collins.
Boulder?
Yeah.
Fort Collins.
We're up in Fort Collins, yeah. We're about 50 miles north of Boulder. And I'm actually starting to consider trying to develop a center for the study of alienation, or parental alienation. I'm sort of starting to explore some options. Probably have to have a capital fundraising campaign at some point through the university to make this happen. But I have this kind of vision in my mind of really setting up an academic center for the study of it, having visiting scholars come in and collaborating on research and having training, and also maybe a partnership with the nonprofit that I'm part of for alienated parents called Simply Parent. And so we might kind of have a partnership with them, with a center, and have some advocacy work going on. So I'm excited about some of the stuff that we're starting to plan, and I'm hoping that a center like that will also kind of spark additional research with other people who are interested in this topic. And I'm actually getting a lot of alienated academic parents who are reaching out to me and interested in collaborating. Even though this hasn't been their primary focus of their work, some people are starting to wanting to kind of shift their focus a little bit, or at least do a little bit of work to kind of help out. So I have a policy researcher who's working with me now, who's an alienated mother, I have an alienator and a father who do machine learning, which is really interesting stuff. And they want to do some work looking at internet, like social media use with parents. And so I think some really neat directions that research is starting to go. And I think it'll really help us understand the problem a lot better.
Wow, that's really cool that you're really doing that. I mean, we get so many complaints. We have another group. Judy's on our show doing the parental alienation, but we have a show up on Wednesday night called Families Against Court Embezzlement and Ethical Standards Face Us. And we do a lot of the families that are involved with the probate courts on how they're, brainwashing our elderly people, and the courts get involved and they take the estates of the elderly people. And so for you to be doing that, with parental alienation and letting people know what it's about and how harmful it is to our kids, I think that is really awesome for you to be doing that.
People,
like you say, will come out and do that because you're a target yourself. When you start, speaking out about this kind of stuff, you become a target yourself, And
yeah.
I think that's
yeah,
important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For our listeners to know that,
I had somebody who, it was an interesting analogy, because I have a philosophy, if people, are yelling at you, then I'm just going to get louder, right? Kind of like that example that, I forgot, what's your name? What's his name? Your example of, okay, well, fine, I'll get louder, right?
yeah.
Of course, it makes you a bigger nail to hit by the hammer, but at the same time, my hope is that by getting louder, it gets other people to get loud, right? And so, because other people need to speak up, because we shouldn't be silent about this anymore, that this is unacceptable. Our kids are suffering. We're suffering. And I just actually finished a national poll. I had raised, my university had given me some seed money to conduct a poll divorced parents. So it's representative of the whole country. Because I was trying to see prevalence of parental alienation among these parents and look at how it's affecting their mental health. And I just pulled the data down this morning. And I can give you a teaser that about 20% of the parents who are feeling like they are being alienated from their kids, about 20% of them have thought of suicide in the last year. That's just 20% of all divorced parents who feel like they want to commit suicide because it's related to custody issues. Now, I have to look at what percentage of parents who feel like they're being alienated. That's going to be another issue. But there's a lot of people being affected by this, and I just hope other people are getting louder about it. I think the more that we can bring awareness to this, the stronger we can get. Somebody gave me somebody told me that they saw me as somebody who, if you go into a football stadium, and you hear a couple boos yelling because some people always hate the opposing team or the home team. But all in all, if you weigh it on the average, I'm thinking hopefully I'm getting a lot more yays and support. And I try to ignore those boos because my hope is that I'm at least trying to hopefully speak for people who, especially the kids, who are not able to speak and have people stand up for them. So. I hope more people can do that. So.
I'm glad to hear you say it. I think that.
Yes, you're back on.
I'm sorry, my internet connection dropped. One of the things that I have experienced working with Lulu and Faces is that a lot of the parents or people that have gone up against the court have experienced other forms of theft. I was wondering if you experienced a lot of parents that were involved with police activity when it comes to robbery, car theft. Have you run into a lot of that?
I haven't heard a lot of that. I mean, I've heard a lot of harassing and stalking done by the alienating parent, and they've got others to help with them or help do that. So they've been targeted a lot. In fact, I have a paper I'm writing with one of my graduate students where, a lot of the parents that are targets of parental alienation really they are just being harassed nonstop by not only the alienating parent, but the in-laws, that parent. And they're to the point where they're scared for their safety. They have cameras up all over their house. I mean, people are leaving dead things on their doorway. I mean, it's horrifying, the things that some of these parents are dealing with. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I've heard of a case actually up in Wyoming where, yeah, the police were got involved and they were doing all sorts of stuff. I think it's because the mother or the father, one of them was dating a police officer. So they had gotten kind of the whole team to go against the other parent. So I've heard of that. I mean, I haven't heard as much about how the court's been involved in behind the scenes on that. I can't speak to that. I haven't heard anybody say that, but I don't doubt that that's probably what's happened to some people. I have heard cases where people's parenting rights have been taken away just by the court, even though they were just fighting in court to have access to their children. And so they were trying to kind of get ACLU and other people behind them to help with that. But so I have heard of some cases like that, but not like robberies and stuff.
Right. Hey, I have a caller that I want to bring in. I think I knew this caller in. 937, you're live.
Thank you. Yes.
Guy.
I have a question. This is Brian Kinter from Ohio. And what I wanted to find out is that do you have any statistical historical data on the numbers of judges that have actively participated in the systematic alienation, the aiding and abetting in the alienation process?
It's a good question. I don't have any statistics. like I said a little earlier in the program, it's hard to even get that kind of data. Like I've had to kind of scramble to even get appellate cases from lawyers who are doing it. I mean, I have heard stories of it. In fact, I've heard anecdotally lots of cases like that. I don't know the extent of it. I have no doubt that it's probably pretty high, especially having even, you know, that classic documentary Divorce Corps about the whole industry behind. I have no doubt that that's probably operating too. And I know some lawyers are buddied up and they say, okay, we got this family. We can buy ourselves new Corvettes with this family. And they perpetrate the alienation and keep it going and fueling it in collusion with the court, right? So I do know that it happens. The extent of it, I have no idea. It's probably worse than I can even imagine. But I like to be optimistic. I like to think that it's not that bad. But I'd love it if somebody can get data like that. Yeah.
Well, we have over
yeah.
3,000 cases, Doctor, that shows the systematic and the systemic abuse. I was the first person in the United States to bring the U.S. Marshals in to shut down a trial court when I sued the judge for aiding and abetting in the parental alienation process. Along
wow.
that journey
okay.
of
Great.
Life, what we've discovered is that the next court up is just as corrupt as the cesspool in which you just left. So it becomes a major, major factor. Now, where we're at today is that and that when you talked about the ACLU, Amnesty International, the Innocence Project, all of these folks, because we in our writ of cert to the U.S. Supreme Court on July 15, 2013, they scheduled our case of 2013. The U.S. Supreme Court had docketed it for oral argument, saying that they needed clarification. But then 2 days prior to us, the United States Supreme Court initiated the Brian Kinter rule, codified as 28.8, which establishes no pro se litigant can take their case before the U.S. Supreme Court. So then the argument becomes is that does a Supreme Court rule set the stage and take precedence over top of the law? Because I believe that's a violation of due process. And in fact, not
right.
only do I believe it's in due process, but I believe now we have the support of 88 of the world's best attorneys that sat on the United Nations Human Rights Council that unanimously agree that in the United States of America, when charging a judge with aiding and abetting in parental alienation, that there is no remedy of redress for the grievances. So much for our Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I think it's a real mess, especially you know, a lot of people can't even afford to appeal it, right? And then you go to the appeals, and sometimes the appellate judges have never had any experience with family court. And you could have an appellate judge kind of case where everybody on the appellate just was in business law or something like that. And so I know that that's the case. I know for one of the districts here in Colorado, you know, there's nobody on the appellate board that actually has experience doing that. And so it's I think there's a real problem and needs to be a lot of reforms for sure. Yeah.
Well, so how do we get to reform?
That's a good question. As
that's
a researcher,
that's
I have no
question
idea.
We have for the night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, and I'm not an advocate. I mean, I work a lot with advocates. I just hope that my research can be used to help people. But I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, system reform is a real problem. I mean, because anytime you want to change a system, there's always people who want to keep it the same. You know, there's always the status quo and there's those who resist it. And so, since I don't work in the legal arena and I don't know all of that, I work with lawyers and judges to help families, but I don't work in that kind of area where, you know, you're dealing with appeals and things. I mean, you know, you'd have to know all the players and you'd have to know who's the ones resisting it. And, you know, I've heard of groups, obviously the American Bar Association, and other people don't want a lot of things to change. Right. So unfortunately, I think you kind of, to make change, you have to address those groups that are being most resistant, because usually the harder you push for a change, the more resistance you get. And so I think it's about trying to weaken the position of the resistance. That's typically kind of how I try to do things. Like as a researcher, I look at what the arguments are against alienation, and I find all the data I can and do research I can to undermine those positions, because then it helps strengthen the case for why, to take alienation seriously, right? If they don't acknowledge it, well, then let's turn how this is. Let's allow the behaviors and undermine the arguments against it, right? And so I think with any system reform, we have to figure out who's the resistor and undermine that position. I don't think it's easy to do in a big system like the courts, but I think you're right to try to get United Nations, get those people behind it, you know, get some outside help.
Yeah, that's a big problem we have, is trying to do some reform, you know, in our courts.
It's not only in our
parental alienation in the family courts. It's in probate courts. It's in family courts and juvenile courts. It's in all kinds of courts. You know,
you look at the number of incarcerations, Lola. Right now, you look at the number of incarcerations and the amount of exonerations and how they've been on an uptick ever since 2010. And you're sitting down and you're saying, our judicial system runs one of the largest, most well-funded, well-organized racketeering organizations anywhere in the world. There is no oversight. Anybody that read the Breithauer case there started off as a $50 million lawsuit, wound up being a $20 billion settlement, and then our own Senate had ordered all of the documentation to be destroyed because of the probability and possibility of the information being disseminated to the masses. You know, you look at these cases and you say, how can we live in a country that professes that we're supposed to have transparency, yet we're cloaked with the protection of secrecy and we operate behind closed doors? This cannot be the show. I mean, it has to change.
We're all with that.
Absolutely.
For every day, you know, and it's going to take our generation possibly to do something. You know, and if not,
it's not going to be a
like
quick change. Yeah, it's not going to be quick. Yeah.
As Brian Kinter said one time.
Unfortunately,
like,
any change, even Brian personal
said,
change takes a long time.
Brian said one time that we don't handle this, we're going to just hand it down to our own kids. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and I thought about that a lot. But anyway, Brian Kinter, he is with the Judicial Accountability Movement. He's on Facebook. You can find him.
Okay.
He's on Jam. So if you ever want to talk to him, his name is Brian Kinter. And Brian, this is Jill Harmon. Yeah, no, it's Jill Harmon.
Jennifer Jill Harmon.
Jennifer Jill Harmon, yeah.
So do you go by Jill, you go by Jennifer?
Jennifer,
okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Harmon.
go ahead.
Yeah.
Doctor. Gosh, it's good to talk to you. This has been a really good show. I've enjoyed every minute of this.
Mm-hmm.
Really have. Anyway, go ahead, Judy.
Good.
You with us?
Did we lose her? Did we lose her?
Huh?
With my dog.
Oh. I have a cat that irritates me every now and then, so I know how it is.
Dr. Hartman, I want to thank you for dedicating your time this evening. I know that you're also a mom and you're also fighting alienation like we all are. And I really thank you for your time and this conversation. It is so empowering to parents like me who have been fighting the system for many, many years, and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. You inspired me. I love your TED Talks, and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Good.
There you go.
Yep. I think I like to use the analogy, this is a war and a battle, and we need people of doing all sorts of things, right? We don't just need lawyers, we need clinicians, we need researchers, we need advocates, everybody in every position, and there's no one way to do this. So I think everybody has a specialty and a skill, and we all have to just bring it, you know, and, I think that's, hopefully we can coordinate actions while we do it, and we're not working in isolation, so we can have greater impact, but thank you.
Okay.
I'm glad you have a podcast for this, and I'm glad that I could be part of it. So,
right, exactly.
Thanks.
Now, if anybody wants to get a hold of you, do you have an email that you want to share with us, or anything in case anybody wants to talk to you or follow up with you with anything?
Sure. Yeah, my work email is usually the best way to reach me. It's JJHarman, Harman, at Kahlo State. That's kolostate.edu. That's my email.
Great.
Lulu.
Okay.
Could I ask?
If they're interested in getting your book, can they find that on Amazon? What's the name of the book? And
yeah.
How can people buy
it? The book. It's Kindle as well as paperback. It's also in Swedish. If you speak Swedish, I had a clinician actually in Sweden hired somebody to translate it so that she could promote it there. So if anybody wants to translate it into another language, I'd be happy to discuss that. It's called Parents Acting Badly: How Societies and Institutions Promote the Alienation of Children from Their Loving Families. So it's a long title, but
wow.
Parents Acting Badly. It's all you have to type into Amazon, and you'll see it's by myself and Zeynep Biringen, and her last name is B-I-R. I-N-G-E-N. So.
Wow, cool. Wow.
Dr. Harman, I'm signing off this evening. Not only did you bring it, but I think you stick it.
Thank you. All right. So thank you so much. All right. We'll be in touch soon, okay? All right.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.